BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the mind chamber where in 28 minutes you and I get to understand a big issue with the help of the top experts on the subject. This week, the government wants to scrap the BBC licence fee. What are the alternatives? At the weekend, Nadine Dorries, Secretary of State for Digital Culture, Media and Sport, tweeted that the BBC licence fee would be scrapped by 2027. Then this week, she told Parliament that it was time to begin asking those really serious questions about the long-term funding model of the BBC. So that's what we're doing today. What other funding options are out there? How do they work? And would they work for the BBC? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, though, it's worth asking why the licence fee model, you pay it if you have a TV, was chosen in the first place. To find out, the briefing room's Ben Carter spoke to Jean Seaton, Professor of Media History at the University of Westminster and the official historian of the BBC, and asked her how the idea of a licence fee first emerged.
The notion of a licence fee was influenced by three quite separate things, one of which was real anxiety about who was broadcasting, and that notion comes from the 1904 Licence to Broadcast Act, when people began to understand that this new fangled thing called broadcasting was around, and people wanted to make sets, so they wanted to be very sure about who was going to have them. They were jolly worried about men in Penge broadcasting propaganda to the British public. Secondly, the post office, which then was seen as the natural manager of anything to do with communications because it ran the post, and the revolutionary idea from the British Post is that you paid one amount of money, for instance, to get a letter from London to Aberdeen or to get a letter from Barnes to Basingstoke, and that was a more efficient economic model of running communications in a nation, and that goes straight onto the BBC licence fee. And Reith, the first director of the BBC, then added a sense that broadcasting was a new industry and that it should bring the best of everything to the greatest number of homes, and the licence fee fitted that.
So funding the BBC from general taxation was not considered at the start?
For two quite separate reasons. A, broadcasting was seen as something extremely trivial. It was about entertainment. Nobody understood that it was going to be as big as it was going to be, except perhaps Reith. And secondly, Reith absolutely manoeuvred to make sure that it wasn't funded directly by the state, because he was very concerned to be independent of any particular government or indeed any particular political party. And he doesn't want taxation.
And in the decades after it started, did the licence fee come under attack?
Until the 1950s, there was no attack on the licence fee. There was some attack on the BBC as a monopoly for two quite separate reasons. Although the post office snaffled a lot of the licence fee revenue that it took in, nevertheless, the BBC grew so exponentially. By 1922, it had about 100,000 licences. By 1926, there were over 2 million licences. By 1936, a decade later, 98% of the country can get the BBC. And so Reith never needs to go back to the government to get a higher licence fee. And of course, it wasn't really until the 80s that you get a radical shift in philosophy. Mrs. Thatcher came in with a very coherent market philosophy. She believed that the market would produce new revenues, but also would discipline the BBC better than the state. And she also thought that you could sell off bits of the BBC to advertisers and the BBC could be funded through advertising. Mrs. Thatcher then set up the Peacock Committee, and the Peacock Report stood it on its head and said, if you were concerned about broadcasting offering a variety of people in a variety of places, a variety of programmes, then in fact the licence fee was the best way of rectifying the real damage that the market did to the public service offer, which he regarded as really important at that point.
So that was 1986. Mm. So what has changed in the last 35 years?
The political landscape from the press has completely changed because public service broadcasters have taken over more and more of impartial news, and they've become more and more opinion-led. And therefore, the BBC, for a lot of newspaper groups, and particularly its prominence online, becomes a more direct competitor. Secondly, the thing we call broadcasting has changed. There are many more sources of information. And the argument has been bounced off of that, that the BBC is just one of many. And finally, I think governments in trouble quite like to biff the BBC, and the BBC is a good bifferoo at the moment.
Jean Seaton on how we got here. Now I want to know how other countries fund their public service broadcasters. Matt Walsh is head of the School of Journalism, Media and Culture at Cardiff University, and Vilde Sundet is a researcher in media and communications at the University of Oslo. Matt Walsh, if we look at public service broadcasters in other countries, how does the BBC compare?
The BBC is pretty large as a public service broadcaster, certainly in comparison with other public service broadcasters around Europe. So last year, the licence fee brought in around about £3.75 billion. It generated about £1.4 billion from commercial activity. So total revenue for the last financial year, just over £5 billion. Really, the only public service broadcaster that's bigger than that, or at least the only market that's bigger than that, is Germany. You know, ARD, it's a comparable size organisation to the BBC. It employs about 22,000 people, funds about 20 TV stations, 60 radio stations, so it's big. And because of the federal nature of Germany, there's a lot of focus on regional television and things along those lines. If you look then around the rest of Europe, well, it drops off quite quickly. So France generates from its fee around £3.2 billion for Radio France and France Television. Italy generates about £1.4 billion for RAI. And then you kind of get into some of the other ways of funding things. So you get things like TVE, which is another big public service broadcaster in Spain, but it doesn't receive license fee money. It just gets a direct subsidy from the government, which generates about £830 million.
Manwash, how does Germany fund its public service broadcast industry? And how much money does it raise?
So the household levy that they have in Germany generates about £6.5 billion for public service media in the country.
Can you just tell us, what is a household levy?
Each household pays a certain amount for public service media. It doesn't matter if you have a television or not. We'll just assume that you're going to access this public service media through some form of device. It could be a smartphone, it could be your laptop, or it could be a television.
Does that pay for just one broadcaster, or is it to pay for lots of broadcasters?
It depends on the model. And certainly in Germany, it's distributed between more people. So it goes to ZDF, ARD, Deutschlandradio. So it goes to a wider range of people than just going to the BBC.
Well, that was very much my next question, which is, historically, did many other countries follow the BBC model? Because I imagine the BBC was one of the first, and pay for their public service broadcasters via something like the licence fee.
Yeah, the licence fee model is incredibly popular if you look around the world through the 20th century. As broadcast networks start to come online, lots of people adapt it. So it's very popular in the Western Europe. Most of the democracies in Western Europe use a licence fee model, but it spreads further afield. So Japan, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa have all used licence fees at some point in their history of their broadcasting, but it wasn't universally popular. So the United States, for example, developed commercial radio very early on and never really had a TV licensing model. Canada had a radio license right back, if you go back into the sort of 1920s, but they dropped it very soon after television started to come online in the early 1950s. So it's a really popular model, although it's also true that many public service broadcasters around the world also use advertising and commercial revenue to top up the license fee revenue too.
Now, has that position been changing?
Yes. So today, lots of countries are moving away from the license fee model. It's the same reasons in lots of different countries as it is here. So firstly, public discontent about having to pay a license fee bill every month. There's also the changes in the way that we consume public service media. We're increasingly device agnostic. We don't care which device we receive the public service media on, just that we get it. And the other issue as well is the kind of threat to commercial media. So lots of commercial media organizations will campaign to try to get license fee money removed from public service broadcasters because it's competitive with their own markets as well.
And is that what happened in Australia?
So Australia had a similar model to the UK if you go back in history, but come the 1970s, they decided to move away from the TV license. There was a kind of widespread feeling in Australia at that stage that the TV license as a model was pretty unfair. And effectively, you'd only really get caught if you didn't have a TV license, if you lived in one of the big cities. If you lived out in the countryside, it really wasn't that much of an issue. So there were lots of protests against the TV license back then. And the Whitlam government back in 1974 decided to abolish radio and TV licenses and switch the public funding to a direct grant, which would fund ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, and it's received a direct grant from the government ever since. These days, totals about £500 million a year.
Vilde Sundet, when we took a look at this, what we discovered was that Norway had changed its system of funding about a decade ago for its state broadcaster NRK. Can you tell us why that happened and what then happened?
Well, it's been debated for almost 10 years and became operative from 2020. Before, we had a licensee fee that we paid for owning a television set that went directly to the broadcaster. And now the system has changed. So we have an individual tax that goes through the state budget, but it's linked to the public service broadcaster. Before, it was, for a family, it was about 3,000 Norwegian kroners a year, and that's about 240 British pounds, and it would be about the same with the new system as well for a family. It was a debate sparked by many of the same thing that Matt discussed. It was both the debate about the level of funding that people critical to the public service broadcaster NRK wanted to make it smaller and reduce the level, but it was also a debate about the model of funding, that how you should organize it for the future. And that was initiated also by people strongly supporting the idea of public service broadcasting and finding that a licensing fee would over time not bring enough money and would not be legitimated by the population, so you needed to change the system.
That's interesting. So both supporters and opponents of the size of public service broadcasting both wanted a change.
Yeah.
Okay, so can you see the amount that you're spending on the state broadcaster in your tax return, or is it lumped into the general amount of tax you pay?
Yeah, I think I can see that in my tax return. Yeah, I think so. But I think it speaks for a lot of Norwegian that we don't really care, you know. I haven't even looked for it. I used to get the payment twice a year and now it goes automatically and yeah.
Okay. So, I completely understand. Now, what has been the impact of the change on NRK in terms of what it can do and what it broadcasts?
I think for NRK, it hasn't been that much of a change. And NRK has also stated publicly that they are very fond of the change. They struggle with the fear of, since the old licensee fee was linked to owning a television device, they fear that if that model was continued, they would lose the hold of young audiences that are consuming a lot of television on mobile or their computer. And so the level of income would be reduced, but also the support for the idea of public service broadcast, that if you get the young generations not accustomed to paying for it, and the whole idea of having a public service broadcaster is that it's a public good and everyone should take part and pay for it regardless of how much they use it. The support for the public service broadcaster is the same, even stronger than before, but I don't think that has anything to do with funding.
Vilde, when we set up the BBC here, the founders of the BBC didn't want to be funded in that kind of a way because they thought it would make the broadcaster dependent upon the state and the whims of politicians. Was there a worry like that in Norway? And if there was, has that worry been borne out?
That was something that was debated, and several white papers, several experts groups, several parliaments discussions and reports. So it's really been something that has been very closely investigated. And in Norway as well, they have considered several different models, also the householding levy, as you already discussed, and adjusting them, the licensing fee. So several different models has been evaluated in the process. And the criteria which was guiding when they came for a decision was that it had to make sure that NRK was still editorial independence, that it had a social profile, that it had support by the public, and that it was simple and future-oriented. So it was quite predictable over time. So it is on the state budget, but the parliament will decide, and that's quite similar to how it was before, that also before parliament would decide yearly, and now it will be every fourth year.
And Matt Walsh, having listened to what Vilde Sundet said about Norway. How does the debate and also the problem of the independence of a public service broadcaster, which can be possibly tagged as a state broadcaster, how's that been represented in the rest of Europe and other countries?
Well, I think there's two really important examples of where this is actually causing live concern at the moment. And the first one is in Hungary, where the government under Orban has moved to take closer control of the public sector broadcaster. And the second one is in Poland. And we've seen in both countries that the government has moved to take closer control of the finances and also the editorial agenda of the broadcasters. And that's led to a drop in their standings in the World Press Freedom Index over time because of the increasingly authoritarian use of the broadcaster to support the state. At the moment, that debate is not really being had in this country, mainly because the debate around how we fund public service broadcasting going forward is still stuck on thinking about things like subscriptions, which aren't really used anywhere in the world to fund public service media.
That was Matt Walsh with Vilde Sundet. So, armed with that new knowledge, I'm ready to ask about the different ways the BBC might be funded in the future and what impact on what we pay, on what we watch and listen to, might different funding models produce. With me to discuss that are Claire Enders, whose company Enders Analysis produces research about the creative broadcast and digital industries, and Patrick Barwise, Emeritus Professor of Media and Marketing at the London Business School and co-author of the book The War Against the BBC. Claire Enders, the model that is most often discussed when it comes to replacing the licence fee is subscriptions as used by the new online platforms and used for a long time by satellite TV. Now, that's something you've looked at specifically. What have you found with regard to the benefits and disbenefits of trying to offer a subscription service?
The number one difficulty is the necessity for a very complex transition towards this model, one that would require significant investment in networks, which we don't believe will arrive at full fruition before the middle part of the next decade. This is full fiber to the home, plus the re-equipment of a very large number of households with new television sets. So the technical phenomenology of subscription is simply mind-boggling when you're moving from a universal service that is accessible to everyone in these aisles. So I would say that this is the least attractive option of all to be considered.
What you're talking about is that a subscription service would exclude people not because they didn't want to pay, but simply because they couldn't get the service, i.e. people who cannot now get Netflix or Amazon Prime. Patrick?
Yes, and that will be true for the next maybe at least 10 years, probably 15 years. Once you go to subscription, even if you had no other problems, the first thing you lose is that the BBC is no longer universal. Now, one of the fundamental tenets of public service broadcasting, including ITV, Channel 4 and Channel 5, is that they're universally available and they provide shared experiences and so on. Leaving that aside, you then look at if you could have conditional access technology. Okay, you've solved this technical problem of being able to shut out people who haven't paid. You're not worried about universality. You then say, OK, what's in the bundle? Is radio in the bundle? And how do you have to price it? And no one knows what the price would have to be to maintain the level of content investment of the BBC.
Well, Claire Enders, let's imagine for a moment that we said, well, we'll cope with the fact it's not fully universal because lots of things aren't fully universal. And we'll cope with the idea that we will have to bundle up all these things together in one subscription. Will we have any idea what a subscription to a service like that might cost?
Well, we have no comparables. I mean, the BBC is producing 20,000 hours of British material a year. The comparable from Netflix is a few hundred. Services that are available on subscription, by definition, are targeted. They can't be all things to all people. They're not a universal church. And to Patrick's point, there is no subscription radio services that you can point to. So if you were going to take the proposition apart, you would then end up with a proposition that only the BBC TV channels and absent the news services would be appropriate to be available on subscription.
Okay, so subscription, that's really complicated, difficult. we can't even put a price on what our BBC subscription
Well, we can't put a price on it, but one thing we know absolutely for certain is that if you wanted to maintain the investment in British programming, and that includes, you know, local radio and, you know, the whole panoply of BBC programming, what we do know is that the average price of a subscription would have to be much higher than the licence fee. Why is that? One reason is that if you have a subscription system, not everybody subscribes. So to get the same revenue, the people who do subscribe would have to pay more. Much more important than that is you have to spend money on marketing. You have to spend money on customer service and account handling and all of that. And so it's the combination of much higher costs and overheads. And if it's not universal, the people who are subscribing have to pay more on top of that.
Exactly.
So, Claire, let's look at advertising then, because that's how some broadcasting is funded. Let us suppose that we moved most or all of BBC funding onto an advertising model. Now, what would that mean?
This notion of advertising on the BBC, whether on radio, online or on television, has been opposed by all of the companies that constitute the significant commercial sectors. Why? Because ITV, Channel 4, Channel 5, Sky, STV, they all live off TV advertising, and it has had a difficult trajectory. It has risen dramatically in the last year, but that was after a fall of around 15% in 2020. Secondly, advertising has been moving onto the online space, in particular onto YouTube, which obtains about £1.6 billion of income in the UK from advertising. So there's a number of reasons why, if you did go down that route, yes, the BBC would be very competitive. However, the total amount of advertising that it could get across television and radio would only come to around half of its annual budget, and about 90% of that $1.6 billion, $1.7 billion would be taken from existing players whose commercial operations would be savagely destroyed.
So it would lead to a big impact on other competitors. They'd lose a lot of money. And also it wouldn't be sufficient for funding the current level of the BBC. Patrick, is that broadly how you see it?
Oh, that's part of it. This actually goes back to 1922. When the BBC was first launched, the newspapers insisted that it shouldn't have radio advertising for precisely the same reason, that they knew quite rightly that that would reduce their own advertising revenue. In the 1980s, there was an independent commission, the Peacock Commission, which was set up to look at this. When it started, the Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, was in favour of advertising on the BBC, as was the chairman of the committee, which he somewhat inappropriately said at the beginning of the process, incidentally. They came down very firmly against, partly for the reason Claire says, which is that they realised that the revenue would all come from other media, particularly ITV and Channel 4. Also, that if you have advertisers paying rather than viewers paying, it incentivises the BBC to do programming which is going to appeal to audiences that are valuable to the advertisers.
Now let's look at taxation, because other countries have actually decided to fund public service broadcasters directly. We know that right at the outset for the BBC, the founders of the BBC were very keen not to be funded by taxation because that might mean government control. Has any of that calculation, Claire Enders, has any of that changed?
Well, we've looked at the countries which have introduced those systems. They tend to be in the Nordics and also Spain. And so it's a better system for countries where there isn't a risk of political control of the broadcaster.
What I interpret from that, Patrick, is that in a Nordic, say the Nordic countries, there is more of a consensus about the idea that the government wouldn't touch public service broadcaster politically,
yes,
than one feels there might be in this country.
Absolutely no question. I mean, I think that even in the Nordics, certainly in Sweden, it's not a complete consensus. The fundamental issue in all countries is that broadcasting is a very important source of news. So all politicians, even the most saintly politicians, naturally want to influence the coverage they get.
Now, let's talk about what you see as viable alternatives. Let's suppose that I pose to you, well, look, the idea of a TV licence fee for various reasons is going to become antique. We're going to have to look at something else. Patrick, if you had to have an alternative, what would you begin to look at?
I would look at a universal household levy. It doesn't matter which particular devices you're using for consuming the BBC's services. It's the household which is paying for everyone in the household, all the BBC services, regardless of the device. If you were to go to a system like that, you could, in principle, address one of the disadvantages of the licence fee, which is that it's regressive because it's the same for all households. And if you were starting with a blank sheet of paper, that would, to me, be the right answer. And there are many ways of doing that, one option being to add it to the electricity bill, which highly correlates with the size and income of the family. The trouble is, if you tried to make it progressive, it's the nature of trying to change taxation that those people who end up paying more, regardless of how much they're paying more, make an enormous amount of noise.
Claire, what do you think? Can you see virtues to something like a household levy? Wouldn't this be a viable thing to look at?
It would, and I think it would have many benefits. First of all, it's something that has been introduced very successfully in a very large number of countries. So it is, in fact, I would say, the standard now is a household levy. It means that, in effect, public service broadcasting is a household good. So if there are older people in the household and they use it more and younger people don't use it so much, that's fine. Their usage is taken as a whole. But on the other hand, you'd have to really think long and hard about whether there was any mileage in spending the money to change a system from the existing one and whether that would actually increase the revenue rather than simply increase the cost, and particularly against a background where the BBC is going to have to tighten its belt.
Let's just talk finally about the mechanism by which we might decide what an alternative to the licence fee would be or whether to keep it. Patrick, what do you think would be the most efficient way of having a discussion and coming to a decision about what that should be?
Well, I think the 1985-1986 Peacock Committee is actually quite a good precedent. So you could have a version two of Peacock Committee, which is a group of independent experts who simply looked at the alternatives. Those people who want, say, advertising or subscriptions would, of course, submit proposals. And in a sense, finally, they would have to put up and say, what is it they're proposing? I personally think that subscriptions would get rejected once finally they were forced to come out and say what exactly they were proposing, because it would be obvious that either we're going to end up with far less good programmes or the price is going to be much higher.
That was Patrick Barwise with Claire Enders. And my conclusion is we could do worse than have a proper, long, independent look at how we want to fund British public service broadcasting in the digital age. Because it's complicated. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirsty Knight, Ben Carter and Rosamund Jones. The programme was mixed by Neil Churchill and the editor was Richard Varden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon, and if you enjoyed it, you may find other episodes interesting, including should we be scared of inflation, could there be a war in Ukraine, and what next for Afghanistan?
From the makers of the Battersea Poltergeist, a new podcast series for BBC Radio 4. Uncanny.
Do you believe in ghosts?
No.
Have you seen one?
Yes.
Real life stories of the supernatural, told by the people they happen to. Presented by me, Danny Robbins.
There was a very strong sense of pure evil.
Subscribe to Uncanny on BBC Sounds.